Devoncast from Radio X.
Another week, another Devoncast. We're nearing the end of another long, dark, cold and wet January, but the pace at which the world of local politics moves is relentless. I'm Guy Henderson and I'm joined this week by my colleagues Bradley Gerrard and remotely Alison Stevenson, who's been doing some work for us out in the field from the Local Democracy Reporting Service. We're also joined today by Exeter University student Finn Aston. Welcome to the studio, Finn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. You?
I'm very good, thank you.
We'll be talking about your podcast on Town and Gown, which is a kind of a way of summing up the symbiotic relationship, the conflict maybe between university and town in a place like Exeter. We'll chat about that a little bit later on. Bradley, we're also going to talk about devolution, aren't we, which has been at the top of the agenda for some weeks now.
It has, yes. Like you say, the government's white paper on devolution came out in mid-December and caused a flurry of activity among councils to try and get their houses in order in terms of what their future shapes might look like, whether there'll be one council in Devon or four or 11 like there are now. Who knows? It's all up in the air still.
Do you think we're any closer to knowing what's going to happen than we were this time last week?
Not sure we are, no. I think that the only thing we're getting closer to is the end of January, so the soft deadline that the government's going to give to respond to councils who've asked to postpone elections. Obviously, here in Devon, Devon County Council has made that request to postpone the elections, which are penciled in for the 1st of May this year. We will see if that request is granted or not.
And in a nutshell, do you think we're heading towards a situation where Devon has maybe four unitary councils, Plymouth, Torbay, Exeter and Greater Devon, an overarching elected mayor system covering Devon and Cornwall?
I think, yes, that probably is the most likely outcome at the moment. I think four councils. I would think Plymouth, Exeter, Devon split into two somehow.
Yeah.
Meaning the rest of Devon outside of Plymouth and Exeter. And then the mayoral strategic authority, I think that's the proper phrase the government's calling it, which would be a system where like an elected mayor would oversee one or more of these new larger unitary councils the government wants to create. I know Cornwall's making a lot of noise about wanting to stay independent and just have a mayor for Cornwall. I'm not sure they're going to get that. That's just a gut instinct. I just think that the government wants larger areas to be overseen by mayors. I don't think they're going to want us to have one county overseen by one. Otherwise, it's going to set a precedent. Every county is going to want one.
This one's going to run and run, isn't it?
Yeah, it will.
It's going to keep us busy for a while. Okay, we'll be following that debate in detail in the coming weeks and months.
But this week, we'll talk about a huge hospital building programme, which has been an awful long time in the making and has delivered mixed results for Devon. And news of Exeter's first official branch of the Reform UK party. Then we'll talk about a huge planning application, which will be considered by Exeter City Council this week.
We'll hear about a new woodland project in the South Hams that's creating something for future generations. But first, let's have a chat with Finn Aston, our Exeter University student, guest in the studio. Now, Finn, you're the host of the new Town and Gown podcast, which is hosted on the Radio X website and Devoncast DAB Radio. The latest episode that you've done sheds light on the mounting tensions surrounding Exeter's student housing crisis. First of all, welcome, Finn. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and your podcast.
So I'm Finn. I'm studying communications at Exeter University. I'm in my second year at the moment and I originally come from Hampshire in the southeast of England. I've always had an interest in radio and this podcast specifically, being a student myself, seeing the unique housing landscape within the city, it being a densely populated city, did really fascinate me. And seeing how students affect house prices, the difficulty in perhaps gaining an affordable house within the city centre, Again, really fascinated me and was something that I wanted to look into more.
It's interesting that this is a topic that comes up very often when I cover Exeter City Council meetings, especially planning meetings, where student accommodation is mentioned. I mean, we'll talk about it a little bit later on. Water Lane development, which they're talking about now, will include some more new student accommodation. But university students are conscious of this as well.
Yeah, they are, especially when you go into the city centre specifically. A lot of spare spaces, say for example a new development in the last 5 years called the Depot that houses 1,000 students near the bus station in the centre of the city. It's developments like this which some local residents feel students are getting put first before them for so-called affordable housing within the city of Exeter. And students are aware of this, whether they're on campus or not. They know that this city has a unique housing landscape compared to others, and that it may be difficult for it to change anytime soon.
What makes it unique? What is that landscape that's unique?
I think part of it is the high cost of living for the city. When I spoke to students on campus within the documentary, the audio documentary, they were surprised at how expensive it was to live here regarding its lack of proximity to London or other big cities, for example, with the nearest cities being perhaps Plymouth and Bristol. But it's generally because of, obviously, it's a good city to live in, and as Phil said in one of my audio clips, which will be played in a bit, there are lots of key institutions in the city, such as John Lewis, the Met Office. There's lots of commerce and work here, and it's all of these factors with students added on top can seem a bit too much, and that is what is creating this pressure in the local housing market.
Now, you got out to speak to some fairly prominent councillors as part of the podcast. You spoke to students as well, but maybe we'll hear one of your clips first. You spoke to Diana Moore, the Green councillor for St David's, who's the joint leader of the Progressive group on the City Council. Tell us a bit about how that came about and what she had to say, and then we'll play your clip.
So I contacted Diana to get involved with the documentary, which she was very, very keen and really wanted to get involved with, which was really good. And I kind of asked what her stance was on the housing situation, and she focused, like, one of her main points was that a lot of it comes down to planning policy, which hasn't changed within the city. And this was something which I thought was interesting, that her and some of my other interviewees had differing opinions, but her main points touched on what she sees in her area, because her area has quite a lot of students living within it. So she sees these problems firsthand, perhaps more than other people in other areas of the city.
Let's hear from Councillor Diana Moore.
Do you feel that is anything that could be put in place for the price of rent for students to go down? Because it is getting to the point where the landlords are literally charging what they want. What do you feel on this?
Shocking, isn't it? And I've also seen what the estate agents do, and they're complicit in some of this. And I would ask, challenge to the estate agents, because they put the fear into students that if you don't book your house, you don't find your house in the middle of your first year when you've just arrived and you know nothing about Exeter, then you'll have nowhere to live.
Yeah.
So it creates a fear factor, and I think that's really unfair on students. £600 a month for a room in a house is a shocking amount of money.
Yeah.
And this is why people, there is a housing crisis, because people who aren't students are competing with students, and that's where there's this perceived antagonism, because, or maybe it's a real antagonism, because people can't find anywhere affordable to live. There aren't any controls. The only things that the council has powers to control over is the quality of the housing. And I think that's really important, particularly if there's damp and mould.
Yeah.
And that can be enforced, and rightly so. And if landlords are going to be charging that money, they need to make sure that they are giving good quality accommodation, providing good quality accommodation. So, yeah, no, it's a free market free-for, and students are being fleeced because of that, in the same way that people in the city are. So, are they providing proper places for the bins to be stored? Are they providing decent homes which aren't, which don't have damp and mould, and which are securely locked and have bicycle storage? Because at that price per month,
yeah,
you should have very good quality places to live.
Interesting. I mean, that raises questions there which I hadn't really thought about, to be honest, Finn, about students themselves being exploited by unscrupulous landlords in university towns. Is that a factor in Exeter?
It definitely is a factor in Exeter. Yeah, there's a real kind of pressure, which Diana alluded to in that interview, that there's a real kind of fear factor among students when they join the university, that within the first 2 months of joining Exeter University, you should have met all your housemates for next year and put your deposit down on a house that's near campus. And I witnessed this myself. I'm living slightly further away from campus because I didn't know who I wanted to live with for the next year after this. Lots of other universities, such as my local university back home, this isn't necessarily a factor. People can find houses for their second or third years when they would like. But in Exeter, there is a bit of a pressure and a stigma around finding your house within the first month or two of university, which I found myself to be quite a pressure, and it's not that pleasant, really.
The next clip that we've got, you've spoken to the leader of Exeter City Council, Labour councillor Phil Bialik, and Phil often speaks in the debates when we talk about students, when we talk about student accommodation, about how valuable students like yourself and the university are to the city of Exeter. I did look up an Exeter University study which came out in 2022, which said that the university is worth £1 billion a year to the Devon economy, which is an extraordinary amount of money. That includes spending with suppliers, that includes wages. It also includes spending by students, although I imagine students aren't particularly well heeled these days. It's you're not exactly splashing the cash as much as perhaps you'd like to. But £162 million spent by students on housing, travel, food and entertainment. The university supports 3,600 jobs, almost all of them people living in the county. And as one of the 24 Russell Group universities, Exeter has students from more than 130 countries. I'll be honest, I didn't know there were more than 130 countries. But, I mean, that's quite something. Let's just hear what Phil Bialik has to say about the value of the university to the city of Exeter.
What impact do you think on the average price of a house in Exeter and the rents in Exeter do students bring? Do you feel the large student contingent which comes down from different parts of the country each year affects this price?
Well, first of all, I was born and bred here in Exeter, proud of it, happy to be here. So the pressures that it brings on housing prices. So the university brings a lot of revenue into the city by virtue of the spend that university students have. They're spending in our shops, they're spending in our cafes, in our restaurants. They're also important to the economy because many of them have part-time jobs, and most probably a lot of places wouldn't be able to exist if it wasn't for students. And it's quite noticeable during the summer break when the students are here, the dynamic of the city changes. And so therefore, being a successful city with a successful university, unfortunately, we're victims of our own success. A successful city, guess what? People want to live here. People want to move here. We encourage businesses here. You've got big centres like IKEA, the Met Office, John Lewis. These are key institutions that we've got, and we want to keep them here, and we want people to stay here and work here. But of course, that puts pressure on housing, of which obviously there's a student accommodation pressure as well.
And as you alluded to, there's loads of students in Exeter, Russell Group University. That is why they are attracted to study in this city. Where do you personally believe they should live? Of course, first year students traditionally do live on campus. The East Park development has been finished in the last 5 years to house even more students. Do you believe they should live on campus or further into the city centre?
Well, what we don't want to do is to create ghettos, in my view. However, where students live, it needs to be appropriate. You know as well as I do, there's students living all over the city. They can live in anywhere. You know, they're not a class of people which can't live in an ordinary house. And I know in the ward I represent, in Exeter, there are students in houses. And they're not HMOs. They are people living in houses.
Phil Bialik there talking about the value of the university. That's something that's got to be borne in mind, isn't it? When you talk about trying to get student accommodation in, you have to look at the bigger picture. You have to look at the value of the university.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when you look at the part-time jobs that students have around the city, whether it be in nighttime venues or in shops. He did allude to that in the summer when the students are there, the vibe around the city does change slightly. You notice, of course, less young people in the city, but to some extent spending may drop because these extra residents in Exeter, which doesn't have a massive population as it is, really does decrease. But obviously it's very important to the city's economy, and being a part of the Russell Group, which is a worldwide, like it's renowned, a renowned institution of its fantastic research, it does offer something fantastic for the city and definitely adds something extra to the city which other cities in the southwest of England might not have.
What is there then that can be done in Exeter to make the housing situation better? This, as you say, it's a small city. There aren't too many places you can put loads of houses that are near the campus, I guess. So have you had any inkling at all from anyone you've spoken to about how one potentially even starts to overcome this problem?
One thing which was spoke about with Diana was that in the summer months, when so many of these HMOs are not used in St David's, Heathertree, Polslow, etc., they could potentially be turned into something similar to an Airbnb, almost like a guest house. So these landlords have extra income coming in the summer months. They don't have to charge quite as much to the students who are living there from September to June, because you've got to count, obviously, account in their months where they do a bit of maintenance work, and things like that. That is why they perhaps charge slightly more, that you're not like most other tenants within a rented property where you're there year round. You're only there even over Christmas, obviously they're not there, Easter they're not there, but this is definitely something to bear in mind, and that is something which could potentially be done.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, Finn, while we've got you here, what's the student experience like in Exeter? The attitudes to students, the relationship with the locals, the relationship with the local community. How do you find it? Do you feel welcome?
Yeah, I feel very welcome here. It's a really nice city. It's very safe, which I think helps for a lot of students first time away from home. It does create, you know, you're a bit nervous about moving somewhere new, but it's so safe. I found it very welcoming, and the local people, when I've been in shops, restaurants, at Radio X, for example, it's been very, very welcoming, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and my friends at university have found it to be that way too.
Excellent. Finn, tell us where we can find your podcast. It's on Radio X website.
Yeah, and it's on the Devoncast website, and it's airing on DAB Devoncast Radio right now as well.
Town and Gown.
Town and Gown is the name of the podcast, yeah.
We'll put a link into it somewhere. Now, the relationship between Town and Gown is going to be put to the test on Monday evening this week. That's the 27th of January, when Exeter City Council's Planning Committee considers an application for up to 1,000 new homes at Water Lane. Purpose-built student accommodation will be one of the first things to be built on the banks of the Exeter Ship Canal if and when the development goes ahead. The land, which has been a meat rendering plant in the past among some other brownfield uses, and there certainly are brownfield uses there, has been earmarked for housing for a long time, but this application from the Water Lane Development Company marks a significant development. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Richard Clark from the applicant. You'll have heard that on Devoncast. He took us through some of the details. Now, a report to the Planning Committee outlines some of people's reservations about the proposal, including the loss of Gabriel's Wharf, which is a key part of the city's maritime business, the only place in the vicinity where a heavy crane can get in to move things around. It's also the place where the former Brixham trawler Marie Claire is lying half-submerged against the quay. The Marie Claire will be removed as part of the development, but for the moment, she's a reminder of the importance of Gabriel's Wharf. I just wanted to flag that up, really, because that's a big, big planning application coming up before the City Council on Monday, and we'll keep you up to date with everything on that Water Lane project as it goes ahead.
But next on Devoncast, which comes from the Local Democracy Reporting Service and Radio X, that hospital building programme.
Now, which hospitals will get government funding for rebuilds and major revamps, and when, has been long awaited, and this week the timetable was announced. But whilst Dereford Hospital's Emergency Care Centre has been included in the first wave of projects to be constructed in the next 5 years, Devon's other hospitals in line for cash, Torbay and North Devon, will have to wait a while longer. The new hospitals programme, initiated by the previous Conservative government, was to see around 40 of the country's most out-of-date hospital buildings upgraded by 2030. But when Labour came to power last July, they raised doubts over the timeline and started to review into the £20 billion programme. The government confirmed this week that all projects in the new hospitals programme will be built, but it will take at least 10 years longer. Health Secretary Wes Streeting said the Conservatives' plan was unfunded and undeliverable, and called its new timetable honest and affordable. It will be backed with £15 billion of new investment over consecutive five-year waves, averaging £3 billion a year. Hospital buildings, primarily constructed with the reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, or RAC, which is prone to collapse, have been prioritised for the first phase of the funding to secure patient and staff safety. But so have a number of schemes coming in at £500 million or less, including one at Dereford Hospital. Torbay will not see its rebuild until 2032 at the earliest, and it will be at least 10 years before North Devon District Hospital gets its new critical care building. But first we go to Plymouth, where there are celebrations as work will start on the new emergency department this summer. The hospital saw 5 critical incidents last year due to pressures within the healthcare system, and a large number of ambulances queuing outside A&E is a regular sight. The health secretary came to see the challenges for himself himself when he visited before Christmas. The city's two Labour MPs, Fred Thomas for Moorview and Luke Pollard for Sutton and Devonport, say they've been fighting tooth and nail to get Derriford on the priority list. Here is Fred Thomas after the announcement.
What an amazing day to be the local MP for Derriford Hospital. The Labour government are delivering for Plymouth. We're getting our new A&E that I've been fighting for so hard. I attended an A&E night shift just before Christmas. I invited Wes down, begged him to come. I've had meetings with him, multiple meetings with him and ministers in Parliament. He came down over Christmas. And today, the Labour government is delivering the new A&E for Plymouth that we've been promised by the Conservatives for so many long years, so many empty promises. The money was never there. We're doing it. I'm so proud to say that.
Current emergency medicine facilities are approaching 50 years old and the emergency department is said to be no longer fit for purpose. Here's Future Hospitals Director Stuart Windsor reacting to the news.
There's been a huge amount of work by a lot of people to make this happen, with huge support from all of our stakeholders, cross-party support across all of our local MPs and council. So huge amount of work to get to this stage. We can now finally make it happen. The building behind me will rise from the ground. It will be four storeys, providing two storeys of new emergency care facilities. The ground floor will contain our resus, where the sickest patients are treated. The first floor will be all around same-day emergency care, and then we've got two floors of theatres that will really support the work that we do as a tertiary centre here in Plymouth. In the meantime, the new urgent treatment centre will be opening in the Dartmoor building just at the edge of the site, and that's a really, really important facility that will enable us to see through the next few years. So a huge, huge step forward, and really look forward to seeing the building rise out of the ground over the coming months, with a view that we will be open and operational in 2028-2029.
Future Hospitals Director Stuart Windsor there delighted it's all systems go for Derriford. Meanwhile, in North Devon, it's a different picture, where patients and staff will have to wait for at least another decade to see improvements. The area's Liberal Democrat MP, Ian Room, said the news of the delay was a devastating blow and he now feared for patients' safety.
We are the remotest hospital in England, and given on mainland England, should I say, and given the fact that we're the most remotest, it's not a simple case of, if you're in London, for example, and an hospital's full, you're only travelling 20 minutes to the next hospital. In North Devon, some of my residents will have over a two-hour drive. If you're living in Linton, Lynmouth, on the edge of Exmoor, or you're living in Ilfracombe, it's going to be at least an hour and a half to get to Exeter.
Do you think the government's chosen some of the cheaper projects? It looks like Derriford's going to get the money, isn't it? And that project looks to be £500 million or less. North Devon now, it looks at £1 billion to a £1.5 billion cost. I mean, it was £600 million, wasn't it? Why has it gone up so much?
Right, so today's figures, if the government gave us the money, we could do it for £660 million. That's what's in the business case. What they have done, they've used the building costs calculated by the Treasury and used the 2028 forecast figures to come up with that figure. But in today's money, it would be £660 million. I was shocked when it said £1 billion to £1.5 billion. But it doesn't alleviate the problem that we've still got theatres that are out of date.
When I visited the hospital, I know you've got half the amount of theatres that you actually need. You need eight more, don't you? And lots more intensive care beds. How is the hospital going to cope with the increasing population?
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? This is why we need the injection now. And I don't think the government's fully, in their criteria, fully understood and taken all the demographics into consideration. It eludes me to say that where they've got these forecasts from, I mean, some of the criteria that they've used is okay in a business case, but I don't think that they've done it in a holistic way. We haven't had one visit from this government to North Devon District Hospital, and we also haven't had any with me engaged with NHS England visit. So I'm pursuing those cases now, trying to get every opportunity I can in government to make them aware of the actual situation, rather than looking on a piece of paper at a business case.
So do you think there's something you can do to speed it up then? This looks like a definitive list, 5-year waves of projects. How do you think you can get money for the hospital then?
Well, they are going to have to give cash injections to bring the theatres up to date, because they are at end of life. I know that the hospital have told me that even the air conditioning units that are used in the theatres are being patched up with parts that aren't even available now. So it's basically, it needs that investment. So they're going to have to invest anyway. And they will just say that's down to the integrated care board to fund that. But at the end of the day, it's basically it needs doing, it needs a cash injection. And therefore, I will be putting the pressure on in any way we can. We can even deliver it in phases. We need the residences up. You know, I was in a meeting with a previous government with Lord Markham, and he promised that it had been done in February 2024, that spades would be in the ground. But was it? No, it was not.
Ian Room there talking about his disappointment over the news that North Devon District Hospital won't get its funding yet.
Torbay MP Steve Darling was angry and disappointed when we spoke to him immediately after the announcement was made. Torbay was one of Boris Johnson's much-vaunted 40 new hospitals, which came at the time in 2020 as a huge relief to staff and patients. It's well documented that the ageing Torbay Hospital buildings suffer from sewage leaks and poor ventilation, among other woes. The most shocking story to emerge for me was that poor ventilation in the post-mortem room of the mortuary had resulted in a member of staff contracting tuberculosis from a dead patient. Just think of that. That's like something from a Victorian horror story, isn't it? Doesn't that show you something about the state of some of our, the elderly estate at some of our hospitals?
I mean, yeah, I guess some of these places were built quite a long time ago now, and the types of medical professionalism and skills and procedures that go on now probably changed radically even in the time that the hospitals were constructed.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. And the estate is aging. Some of these things just really can't wait. But nothing happened to move the project forward before the general election last year, leading to speculation that the money for doing the work was never really there in the first place. But since the election, Labour has also been reviewing the rollout of the programme, saying it's been doing so against the backdrop of chaotic public finances. Now it seems as if Torbay won't be started until 2032 at the earliest. And Mr Darling is not best pleased.
I am shocked and disappointed with these proposals from the Secretary of State. This is nothing but a double betrayal by the previous government, who failed to bring home the bacon, and now we're looking at a significant delay for the improvements to Torbay. Torbay will sadly continue to suffer from significant sewage leaks, many of them affecting clinical areas within the hospital. We're already operating at a 98% capacity. This means that people are not receiving the services that they deserve. My fear is that residents will be suffering all the pain of the National Insurance contributions hike that will impact on our low-wage economy in Devon, without actually seeing the benefit of that money being invested in our NHS immediately in Torbay.
Brad, you've also been hearing a little bit more about the establishment of an official presence by Reform UK in Exeter. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I have, Guy, that's true. So Ed Hill, who's a former Marine, is now the chairman of the Exeter branch of Reform UK. The group held its inaugural meeting in Exeter on the 21st of January, with Mr Hill being elected as its chairman by the members present. Mr Hill now has ambitions to run as a councillor in the city council elections next May, and potentially for Parliament at the next general election. Now, Reform UK did put up a candidate, Lee Bunker, in the 2024 general election in Exeter, but Mr Hill said the party didn't have a branch in Exeter at the same time. I started by asking Mr Hill about the process of setting up the branch and whether he believes he can gain an even bigger following than previous Reform candidates in the city.
So if you want to become a Reform candidate or open up a branch, you have to be vetted by Reform UK HQ, which is exactly what I've done. I've followed all of their policies and procedures. I've been in contact with them through the process, and we have officially became a branch of Reform UK.
Exeter had Lee Bunker run as its Reform candidate in the general election last year. So was there another branch already established? Have you sort of superseded a smaller existing one? Or is this generally the first time Exeter has a Reform UK branch?
No, so Lee Bunker actually lives in Plymouth. Exeter didn't have a branch up until yesterday. So Lee Bunker was a paper candidate for the election. He didn't actually do any campaigning. He put his name on the ballot paper in Exeter just so that people had somebody to vote for Reform in the city. He didn't deliver a single leaflet. He didn't knock on a single door. He was purely a paper candidate, but he still got something like 5,000 votes, 13% of the vote, I think, in Exeter without any campaigning at all.
So presumably you're hoping you can build on that, are you?
Absolutely, yeah. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party have broken so many promises in their times in office. In the last 6 months, the Labour Party, with the winter fuel allowance and the two-child benefit cap and things like that, people didn't vote for this when they voted for the Labour Party, but all of the Labour MPs have backed these motions. One or two of them maybe have defied the whips,
But isn't that politics? You're in opposition, you disagree with things, and you get into power and you realise what things are really like, you see behind the curtain. Maybe you just can't do everything you said you would do. That's life, that's politics, isn't it?
Well, you can though, can't you? So if I am voted in as an MP and I've campaigned for the last 6 months or 2 years, whatever, on a certain policy, and then Reform wins and I'm a Reform candidate, Nigel Farage turns around and says to me that he wants me to vote against the thing that we've been campaigning for the last 2 years, I would defy the whip and I would vote against Reform if that was the case. But I can't imagine it being the case. I think Nigel Farage and Reform has got too much integrity and accountability to do something like that. But if he did...
Isn't Mr. Farage very good at grabbing a headline and saying the right thing? Do you honestly think that he wouldn't actually have to go against... If in a world where he had enough power to become the Prime Minister, do you think really there's a world where he wouldn't have to go against something he said that he would provide, but when he gets into power, he just realises that he can't?
I stand for values and standards. I stand for accountability. So if there was a situation that Nigel Farage had made a promise that he couldn't keep, I wouldn't stand by his side. That's what Reform is about. We are basically, we're not career politicians. I didn't get into politics because I wanted to be a politician for my entire life. I got into politics because of a range of circumstances that have pushed me down this path. And I'm not going to vote with a party just because I want to advance my career, which it seems to be what's happening at the moment with the Labour Party politicians that never defy the whip.
And so what is it that is driving you to try and become a politician then? And also within that, what are your goals? We've got the city council elections probably next year, a general election in another 4 to 5 years. So what's your political trajectory and what is it that's making you want to try and become a politician?
Well, I've got quite a colourful background as far as my life's concerned. So I understand a lot of people's issues because I've actually lived them myself. For example, when I was 16, I left school without any qualifications at all because I was dyslexic and nobody realised. And then I was made homeless also at 16 as well. So I was actually homeless. I was housed by the council at the time in a house full of drug dealers and drug addicts, which instantly stopped me from taking any drugs or anything like that for my whole life because I just saw what drugs could do to you. I saw the sharp end instantly, so I just rejected that aspect of life. I became a forklift truck driver when I was 18 years old, and back then I actually hit the 40% tax bracket driving a forklift truck because people were paid for their skills when I was 20 years old. There wasn't a minimum wage that has just basically compressed so many jobs into what we now consider a minimum wage job. Driving a forklift truck is a minimum wage job now. But back then, when I was 20 years old, I was getting paid a couple of pounds more than everybody else in the factory, and I could do as much overtime as I wanted.
But just because that's changed, doesn't mean it's right before. Maybe you were being paid the wrong rate before.
I mean, what happened is a lot of people came over from the European Union and lots of low-skilled workers, compressed wages. If you speak to people in offices that carry out all these statistics, they'll tell you that wage compression didn't happen. But I lived it. And I think a lot of people listening to this that are my age group will resonate with what I'm speaking about at the moment. People that are 46 years old now but worked in factories in their 20s were recognised that wages were higher for the work that they actually did, even though the minimum wage wasn't in existence back then. Anyway,
you put the blame on that though purely on immigration though, not on bosses just looking to save money because generally costs are rising, or is it all at the door of immigration that this argument of yours?
If I was running a business, I'm in it to make money. So, of course, I'm going to pay my staff as little as possible. But anyway, why I got into politics. And when I was 27 years old, I became a Royal Marine and I left the Royal Marines a couple of years ago due to an asbestos case that I started with them. I raised the case legally, so there's a legal case going on at the moment, but I also asked a lot of MPs for help. And despite over 200 people being on the case, and we've all written to our MPs, it's just a bit of a damp squid for them. They don't want to deal with it.
So you feel you've been let down by current and former MPs, I'm presuming, of the more major established political parties?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. What I want to do is I want to actually hold people accountable for things like this. And if I'm an MP, if I get into politics, I will actually be in a position to be able to hold people accountable. I just get the impression that when I write a letter to an MP, they copy and paste an email and then they send it back, but they don't follow it up. They don't, you know, dig deep and ask the questions, the difficult questions that need to be asked by the minister that's replied to them. They don't arrange a meeting with me. In all the...
you'll be pushing on doors harder, knocking on them harder, will you, than the MPs do now?
Absolutely, yeah. If somebody needs to be held accountable for something, even if they are in my own party, I will hold them accountable for it.
It sounds like a compelling message that people might appreciate, but I guess how do you know that people do appreciate it? Have you had a chance yet to get any backing, or have you got any idea that what you're saying will resonate with people?
A lot of people in Exeter have never even voted before. And when you dig down and you ask them why, it's exactly the reasons that I'm speaking about at the moment. Firstly, lots of people just think that it doesn't matter who you vote for because all of the parties that are likely to get into power just lie. And secondly, even if they do vote for somebody in Exeter, Labour is so well established that people just think it's a wasted vote, whoever they vote for, because Labour's going to win. But what I'm finding is that in Reform, when I'm speaking to people on the doorsteps, people are saying that they're going to vote for the first time in their life in Exeter, and they're going to vote for Reform after I've told them my story.
That was Ed Hill speaking to me there. And as he kind of mentioned, so Lee Bunker, who was the candidate in Exeter, apparently lives in Plymouth and never really did any campaigning at all in Exeter, yet came third. So Ed Hill is hoping, with a bit of, you know, shoe leather expended around the city, some doors knocked upon and residents spoken to, that he can maybe in the next general election, you know, beat that performance.
It's going to be interesting, isn't it? Very interesting. I remember speaking to the Reform candidate in Torbay on general election night, and he said this is just the start of a 5-year campaign. Reform will gain ground. Finn, I wanted to talk to you about university politics, because way back in the day, back in the late 70s, early 80s, universities were an absolute hotbed of politics, radical thinking. Is it still the case? And is Reform and maybe other parties and groups on more on the right of politics, are they gaining ground in universities?
Politics is definitely still a main talking point within a university campus. However, perhaps slightly less than before. Sometimes people keep their opinions to themselves. We do have societies of each political party. Now, I wouldn't say the universities necessarily majority right-leaning. However, I do know that the parties that do sit on the right do have quite a lot of members, and especially because the university is known for its middle class or upper class student kind of clientele, as it were, that can sometimes be why those parties do attract more members than others in the university.
And is it still the same as it used to be on your first day in Freshers' Week, when you're looking for, you know, sort of like-minded people to spend some time with? Do the political parties come and say, "Why don't you come and join us? You get a free pen or a badge or something."
No word of a lie. I can see it now as I did then. When I walked in the forum, which is like the main kind of hall in the university, the first two people I saw when I came in the entrance, on the left of me was Labour Society, on the right of me was Conservative Society. No word of a lie.
I'm not going to ask you which way you went.
But they was handing out leaflets, incentives, talking about their meetups, their socials, and considering that was the first two societies I saw, it really did open my eyes. I was like, wow, I didn't realise this is what university was like in a political sense, but it did really interest me, yeah.
One thing Ed Hill said to me that was, I thought was quite interesting, was he sort of claimed that when he's been speaking to people about the fact that he's going to try and become a local politician, a lot of people hadn't actually voted in Exeter, he said, because they just felt that Labour was so nailed on, that presumably that would mean these people he's speaking to were not natural Labour supporters. They've just felt that they weren't going to vote. And one of the reasons given to Ed Hill was that Labour's just so entrenched in the city, they just can't ever see it being overturned. So that's kind of interesting that Labour was one of the first ones that you saw through the door of the student hall.
I mean, it's interesting. And the next few years are going to be absolutely fascinating as politics across Europe develops in a certain direction. You're looking at Germany, you're looking at Austria, moving probably more to the right. You're looking at the new regime in America, and it will be absolutely fascinating to see how these things develop. For people like us who are a bit nerdy about politics and find these things absolutely enthralling, let's say, shall we? Finally, if the political debate here and on the other side of the Atlantic is getting you down, here's a story about building something worthwhile for the future. Down in the South Hams, a new tree planting project, masterminded by South Hams Council, has been bringing a community together. Thousands of trees have been planted to create a new woodland at South Brent as part of South Hams Council's drive to plant one tree for every person in its area. Local families came out in force to help create the new Hope Wood, and Council leader Julian Brazil said it would help the council move towards net zero in carbon emissions and create something for the future.
This is a piece of land, it's about 65 acres that we've got funding from DEFRA. The project is to create a community woodland. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about that. We hope this is the start of many, and it's ticking all our priorities along climate change, biodiversity, but also support for, you know, the social. Hoping to plant a tree for every single resident in the South Hams, and this is these are going to be the first few thousand. I think that we need to, you know, as a society, I mean, South Ham's always been pretty good at it, but I think as a society we need to be more, and, you know, more understand how, you know, how nature is so important to us. As a race, as human beings, we've exploited the planet to a certain extent, and if there is to be a proper future for our children and grandchildren, then we need to reach out and help and support it. And this, I think, in itself, the educational benefits that it brings to people, and hopefully there will be children here that will plant trees that will come back in 50, 60 years' time, mm-hmm. And see a, you know, a woodland coming up and just think I'm part of that.
During the course of a chilly January day, trees were planted all along the hillside that will eventually become Hope Wood. Ross Kennelly of Sustainable South Brent said the planting was the start of a long-term commitment from local people and volunteers. The first 2,500 trees have gone in, but the eventual target is much higher, and a total of more than 20,000 trees on the site is just the beginning.
What we've got is a site that runs right back into the countryside over there, the other side of the road, and that includes potentially about 10 acres that we're talking to South Hams at the moment about leasing, that can become a market garden. So a place for people to grow food, to be distributed locally. We're looking at an orchard there for fruit, and potentially a tree nursery as well, so that we can grow trees here that can then go out and replicate this project elsewhere. We need woodlands like this, but we need woodlands that can deliver for not just carbon, but nature, people, food, climate at the same time.
Also there on the day was Ellen Smith from the Woodland Trust, which supports landowners to increase tree cover. The Trust has been closely involved in the Hopewood project, and Ellen Smith explained some of the benefits.
So it's great that we're so close to a lovely community, South Brent, just around the corner, because having access to nature is so key. And I also think there's this amazing energy of seeing a woodland go from this level, growing up, you know, within 10, 15 years, it will just be closing canopy. You're starting to see it turn into a woodland. And so some of these children here today will actually see this turn from what is quite an open, you know, field into an amazing habitat for wildlife and for trees.
Hopewood, taking shape at South Brent in the South Hams. If, like me, you're finding January a bit of a slog, that's a story to bring a bit of light into the gloom. So before we take our leave, Finn, thank you very much for coming in and joining us. Don't be a stranger. We'll use you again on Devoncast, because it's interesting to talk about student issues. It's interesting to talk about the university. Tell us once again the name of the podcast and where we can find it.
So my podcast is called Town and Gown. You can find it on the Radio X website in the podcast section and on Devoncast Radio DAB, where it is airing right now. Thank you very much for having me.
Great stuff. Thanks for joining us, Finn. So Devoncast has been created by Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening, and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe. And remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.